History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold. If we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions and, more importantly, take the time to listen, we're going to end up amazed. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am in Embuto, New Mexico, a beautiful spot along the Rio Grande in northern New Mexico, in a place that Carl Berghofer knows very, very well. He's lived here pretty much all his life, except for a little tour in the Pacific during World War II. We're going to hear about Iwo Jima. We're going to hear about the 3rd Marine Division, maybe about Guam as well. But Mr. Berghofer, I want to know about this part of the world, because it's kind of a little corner not everybody knows about. What do you appreciate about living here?
Our irrigation system was reestablished in 1690, which means there was a system before that, and that was under the land grants from the King of Spain. It was a real primitive area. All the houses were made of adobe bricks. They were designed with no windows on the north side and windows on the south and west and east side for the sunlight. All the heating in those days were wood and had candles and kerosene lamps. Later, kerosene lamps came in later. But it's an old established area.
And how long has your family been here?
My family came to New Mexico in 1921.
And you're still farming at 95?
Yeah, I'm still farming. I'll have to have a little help the last couple of years.
How many acres are you farming?
I've got 7.5 acres on my home place, and then my grandson and my sons have 2 places I'm helping with. They've got about another 7 or 8 acres.
And what all are you growing?
We've mostly fruit. Apples, peaches, plums, pears, cherries, apricots.
And you've known this your whole life, huh? You grew up doing
yeah,
that?
I grew up here in this area.
Yeah, tell me about that, your childhood. I mean, this is the age of the Great Depression, and you're out here in rural New Mexico.
I was born at Taos Junction, New Mexico. At that time, the area had been opened up for homesteading for veterans of the World War I. The Carson and Taos Junction area northwest of here is a big mesa, and the soil is real fertile. In those days, they had abundance of rain, and Taos Junction was a railroad center and also the pinto bean capital of the United States, and they produced lots and lots of produce up there. The homesteaders, most of the houses were made of logs, and a lot of them were dugouts. The one I was born in was a semi-dugout lined with logs. They were real warm in winter and cool in the summer. It was real primitive living, but the veterans got 280 acres of land, and all they had to do was live on it, build a house, and establish some kind of business or agriculture. The area was dried up in the Dust Bowl days in the 1930s, and all the people moved out, and so the land is all vacant up there now.
What about your childhood? What were some of the things that you remember? What did you have to do?
Well, I remember when I was about 3 years old, we had a dog by the name of Ray. And I've got a picture of that dog in the old Model A car that we had. I was raised at up to 4 years old in the Taos Junction area. Then my parents moved out here to Embuto, and they rented a place up here and farmed it for several years. And my father went to work for the highway department. And he was killed in a rock slide. In those days, they didn't have any bulldozers or backhoes, so all the road work was done by teams of horses with Fresnos and scrapers.
Fresno scrapers, yeah.
That was main road construction equipment.
And I was just driving up here. I saw a lot of signs that said, "Watch for falling rocks."
Yeah.
In this river canyon here.
Yeah, he had a rock came off the hill and rolled on him, but it killed him. He lived about 4 months.
So you're 4 years old.
Yeah, I was 4 years old, and I lost my father in 1931, and then in 1929, the Great Depression hit. And then in 1930, we had the Dust Bowl hit, and that moved a lot of people out of all the Southwest, Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas. And I remember the Okies and Arkies were coming through here in droves of the old Model Ts and some Model As going to California to, where they had work and stuff they could do. The Depression and the Dust Bowl lasted until about 1940, and we were just coming out of the Dust Bowl and the Depression when World War II started.
Right. And give me a taste of your childhood, because I'm thinking about your grandkids and people who would be the age of a great-grandkid, right? The teenagers of today or the young kids today, their world's a little different from what you went through.
It's way different. We learned to survive. We raised most of our, during the Depression, we raised most of our own food. We'd raise fruit and chili and vegetables. And in those days, there wasn't any money available. So we'd take a load up, fruit and vegetables up to Tress Peterson, Carson, South Junction area. And we'd trade it, come back, unload our fruit and vegetables. We might make enough money to buy gas to get home on. Then in the fall of the year, people from up there would bring one guy, I remember, Price Smith. He would come down and bring us a half of beef. Somebody else would bring us 100 pounds of beans. And somebody else would bring us 200 or 300 pounds of potatoes. And nobody changed hands. It was just a barter. But we lived good during the Depression. We never missed a meal. But they suffered in starvation in a lot of places.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I had a brother and two sisters. And they're all gone now.
Growing up on a farm, what kind of stuff were you responsible for?
I was, every day after school, we'd get up in the morning early and go feed our rabbits and chickens. And then we'd go to school, and then when we'd come back from school, we'd clean the rabbit hutches and chicken pens and put out new water and gather greens for the rabbits. And then we didn't have any refrigeration in those days. So after school, in the summertime, we'd go up to a people's place up the river and had a big ice house, and we'd cut out a block of ice and bring it back and put it in the ice box for keep our vegetables and things cool. And that was one of the chores we had every evening in the summertime. In the wintertime, we'd go up and help him make ice. We'd cut out blocks of ice on the river, pile one on top of the other, and pour a little water over. The next day, they'd be frozen in a solid block. We'd cut them out, bring them down, and bury them in sawdust in this ice house. And that we had ice all summer long.
Different world.
Yeah, a different world.
Do you remember as a boy having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
I wanted to be a forest ranger. My high school education was cut short because of World War II, so I never did complete high school. I got my GED later and then took a bunch of college credit, non-credit college courses in wildlife management.
And you spent many years with the Department of Game and Fish here, I understand.
I put 32 years in the Game and Fish Department. I was game warden in Las Vegas and Taos for 7 years each, and then I was in charge of fur bears management and the waterfowl and assistant of the waterfowl research program. We batted ducks and geese all over the state, and I made 2 trips into Canada on the banding of waterfowl up there.
Well, you mentioned World War II interrupting your high school years. It seems to me just about everybody I've met who was alive back then has some kind of memory about December 7th, 1941.
I was down on the river running some muskrat traps. I'd trapped every year or catch a few muskrats and occasional mink, and I'd skin them out. We'd send the skins to Sears Roebuck, and the money all went into the family, anything we made on it. Every year we managed to pay the license plate of the Model A Ford and catch up on payments with the money I made out of fur bear trapping business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out running traps one day, and one evening a stepdad came down the river and said, "Sit down a minute." So we sat down and he said, "The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and we're at war now." So that messed up my high school education. I was being self-taught at home. The only way to get a high school education was to get a place to live in Taos or Española. So that stopped my high school education. And then I was 16. I went to work in defense work. Worked one whole winter, and then the following fall, I went to work for the Game and Fish Department. They were short-handed, and I went to work as a trapper producing animals, so coyotes that were killing deer and sheep and things like that, and beaver that were cutting trees and dabbing irrigation ditches. We'd cut trap those and move them and replant them, and that was my job. And then when I was not quite 18, I enlisted the Marine Corps.
What made you want to do that?
Well, my brother-in-law was a Marine back during the Nicaraguan campaign. We discussed which branch of service. He says, if you want to get good training, go in the Marines. If you want to have an easy life, go in the Army. So I enlisted the Marine Corps, and I was called up in July. The quota was full the time I enlisted. And I went to Parris Island for boot training, and in the Cap Lejeune for advanced training, and I shipped overseas almost 6 weeks. I had 3 weeks of boot camp and 6 weeks of advanced training, and then I shipped right overseas.
Wow. Hurry up and go, huh?
Yeah.
What was it like going through boot training and all that? Well, did you feel prepared for it already?
It was different.
Yeah?
They had the Marine Corps boot camp was real intensive training. Lots of discipline, and I didn't mind it much because I had been raised in that kind of conditions a lot, so It wasn't anything particular new, but it was strenuous.
Did you have any idea what to expect when you shipped overseas?
Yeah, I knew what to expect. My cousin had been captured on the Bataan, went through the Bataan Death March, and he died at a concentration camp in Japan of slave labor up there, and he was my aunt's pride and joy, so I had already made up my mind I would never be captured by the Japanese.
So that happened. He was captured before you enlisted.
Yeah, he was captured and died before I went into service.
And you knew he was dead already, or you didn't know?
We got a report from the Japanese that he had died, but we didn't know till later what he died of. And he died of malnutrition, starvation, dysentery.
What was his name?
Harlan Bickford.
And was he from New Mexico also?
Yeah, he was raised out here in Boodle. Yeah. Bought a place down there to build a house on it. And at the same time, my mother and dad were building up this place over here next door to us. The place my son's living now.
So you had known him pretty well?
Yeah, we were real close friends. He was a little older than I was.
And he was Army or?
He was in the Army. He was in the 200th Coast Artillery.
So many from New Mexico were in that unit. That's why
there
are more from New Mexico.
Yeah, there are a lot of Mexican people in it.
More from this state than any other state on the Bataan Death March. How did that impact you when you heard that news that your cousin had been killed?
Well, that was when I made up my mind I would never be a prisoner of the Japanese. But when I went overseas, we got in the tail end of the Battle of Guam. We went in as replacements and got in the tail end of the Battle of Guam. And that was a real serious campaign. The main fighting had already ceased, and we were mopping up remnants of the Japanese army that had holed up inland. The Japanese survived on Guam for a long time. The fact is, the last Japanese on Guam surrendered about 1970, been living off the land and holding up inland.
So what kind of things did you experience there at Guam? I mean, this would have been
first... It was jungle warfare and lots of cliffs and caves and so on in the backcountry. We were mopping up the remnants of the Japanese army on Guam. We got a lot of combat, but nothing really serious, nothing like we ran into when we went to Iwo Jima.
But it gave you a taste anyway, right?
Yeah.
The stakes that were in order?
Yeah, it gave us a taste of combat.
You told me you made up your mind you'd never be captured.
Yeah, that was my greatest fear.
More so than being killed?
Yeah, I was more afraid of being captured than I was of being killed.
What were the other guys you served with like?
They were a nice bunch of guys. I had George Cage from Durango, Colorado, and Bob Bell from Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and Bert Jane from Missouri were in the same fire team. We went through boot camp together, went overseas together, in the same fire team on Guam, and the same fire team on Iwo Jima. Of the four of us, there was two of us were wounded and none of us were killed.
That was no small feat, given the odds that were working against you, especially on Iwo.
Yeah, we went to Iwo Jima. We had a full company of men, of 240 men, and in the campaign there was 11 of the original men still active.
Those numbers would suggest that this 18-year-old survived some pretty serious situations on Iwo Jima, and we'll hear about some of them when we come back, including the incident that left Carl with the Purple Heart, but without a little piece of his skull. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos of Carl Berghofer then and now, and we'll be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at ProvidentPayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with Carl Berghofer of Embuto, New Mexico. He turns 95 this week, and he'll celebrate by doing what he does every day, tending to his orchards along the Rio Grande like he has for three quarters of a century. We're going to go back, though, to the year before he purchased that property, back to February 1945. Carl was an 18-year-old Marine on his way to Iwo Jima.
So many of the vets I've talked to who served on Iwo Jima, who fought in that battle, most of them had never heard of Iwo Jima before they got there.
Yeah, well, I never had heard of it.
Did you know where you were going when you headed that way?
Yeah, we found out a board ship going up to Iwo after we loaded to Guam and went up to Iwo Jima, and they announced on the speaker system we were going to Iwo Jima. We got up there, and the 4th and 5th Division were the first waves ashore.
Right.
And the 5th Division went across the island, cut it in two, and then turned north on the west side, and the 4th Division landed on the east side of the beach and went up the east side. The 3rd Division was in reserve. My division was in reserve, and we went ashore on D+1, the evening of D+1. The 4th officers were suffering heavy casualties, and we went in to replace them, and we went up the center of the island.
You know, it's been famously said that the estimates were it would only take 3 days to take that island. Did they tell you guys that?
We were there for more than 30 days.
Well, and I imagine if they thought it was going to be over in 3 days, they probably didn't think they'd have to send the reinforcements in as early as you guys went in.
Yeah, we went in early.
And what did you see? Can you help us understand what it was like for you?
We watched it from the ship, and it was just a cloud of smoke and dust and bombing and artillery shells. And then when the Marines went ashore, well, they landed almost unopposed. And after they got ashore, then the Japanese opened up on them and tried to hit them at the beach. They hit a lot of the shell fire, hit a lot of landing boats, LSTs and Higgins boats. And the beach was cluttered with torn up, destroyed ships. And we went ashore. We couldn't get to the beach, so we unloaded on an LST and climbed the rope ladder into the LST and then went off the ramp or get ashore.
Because there wasn't enough room from all the...
Yeah, all the wrecked vessels.
Wow.
They had boats in there trying to tug the boats, the wrecked shell boats out off the beach.
You guys were going in a Higgins boat, in an LCVP, and then couldn't make it in?
We were going right at the heart of the shell power of the beach.
I can't imagine what that must have felt like, to see all that in front of you and wonder what's going to happen to you.
Iwo Jima was, I still have dreams about that damn place. It was black sand and pumice. You'd take a step going up the terraces onto the beach. It was a series of terraces that were wind and water formed. You'd take a step up and you slide back a half a step. The only way you get up the terrace is get down to your hands and knees and crawl and get up on one terrace and take shelter and rest, and then you climb the next terrace.
And meanwhile, and there's still incoming fire.
Yeah, we were under fire the whole time. But we made it up on the beach, and then we captured some of the Japanese foxholes and so on. And we went ashore. I'll never forget the smell. There was two smells I've never outlived. The smell of rotting dead bodies and blood, and the smell of sulfur. The whole island that was named Iwo Jima because it was Sulfur Island, and it supplied a good part of the sulfur for the Japanese armament. The whole island stunk of sulfur, and the center of the island was an extinct volcano, and then the volcano on the south, Mount Suribachi, that's the one that raised the flag on. I was on the beach when the flag went up, by the way. But the northern part of the island, you dig a foxhole down and dig those sulfur pumice bricks out, and they'd be plumb hot. They were hot enough to heat your K-rations on.
Wow.
The smell of sulfur permeated the whole island.
Doesn't sound like a very comfortable place to be.
Well, it sure wasn't. They had three airstrips on the island. The reason we took it is capture those airstrips,
right,
and make a landing strip for returning B-29s coming from Japan, bombing Japan. We also put fighters on there to accompany the B-29s clear to Japan, give them fighter cover.
And that's something that some have debated over the years. Some have suggested, yeah, did we really need to take that island, especially at such a heavy cost?
Yeah, it was heavy cost.
And you, here you are, 18 years old.
Yeah, I just turned 18, about 18 and a half when I went to Iwo.
And you're seeing things you've never seen before.
Yeah, I got used to it in a hurry.
And you said something. You were on the beach when the flag went up.
Yeah, I was on the beach when the flag went up, and we were under shell fire. And the ship's whistles all went off all over around the island. All the ship whistles went off, and we looked up, and they had raised the first flag on Iwo Jima. It was a little flag. You could barely see it. They raised two flags. They won the picture was the second flag.
Right. Did you see that one go up as well?
Yeah, I saw it go up as well.
Yeah, the story goes that James Forrestal, Secretary of the Navy, wanted the first flag as a personal souvenir, but Marine Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson wanted to make sure it stayed with the 2nd Battalion, 28th Regiment, 5th Marine Division, that had made its way up Mount Suribachi to plant that flag. So Johnson issued orders to have a replacement flag sent up, and of course he said, make it a big one.
He thought the first flag was too small. It wasn't very big. I would say it was probably 3 by 4 feet.
And you said the ship's whistles were going off because they're all watching.
Yeah.
And they see this flag, and that signifies
we were firmly in possession of the island.
So for you, being on the beach and seeing that, what did that mean?
It was a big morale booster, believe me.
Did it come to register as a bit of false security as well, though, because of there was so much battle left to fight?
You know, well, it gave us we knew we were firmly in possession of the island at that time, but we knew there was a lot of hard fighting ahead of us, and there sure was.
Because you had basically another month there after that.
Yeah.
What was that month like?
We made the assault on the second airstrip, my unit did. That was a bloody mess. The Japanese were dug on the other side, and we charged that airstrip, got across it, and captured the first trenches and entrenchments. And I remember looking back, and there was dead and wounded Marines all across that airstrip. They got a lot of our people. After that, we had cover. That was the only uncovered attack we made, was across the airstrip. But the rest of the campaign, we were just one ridge and one foxhole to the next. We'd move ahead. Maybe take 50 yards in a day. Then at night, we could lay in our foxholes and we could peel the vibration of the Japanese, digging out the caves underneath us. And the next day, there'd be as many Japanese behind you as there was in front.
Wow.
They had that whole island riddled with tunnels. You could go from one end to the other of that probably seven different ways and never go through the same hole twice.
Which makes it pretty difficult on you, I imagine.
Yeah.
And it sounds pretty exhausting.
We'd burn out, with flamethrowers burn out the tunnels and the caves we found, and then dynamite them shut. And that next night, the Japanese be digging them out and open them up again.
And you did some of that?
Yeah. I never did operate a flamethrower. I was a rifleman, but I'd carry shape charges and Bangalore torpedoes. Mm-hmm. They were real effective against the caves.
I'm just imagining being in your shoes, an 18-year-old kid dealing with all this.
Yeah, I got a rude awakening on evil, believe me.
Well, and it sounds like you never know where the enemy's coming from.
You never knew where they were coming from, and they were really dug in. We'd maybe make 50 yards a day, and then toward the last of the campaign, we made a night assault through the Japanese lines to the North Beach, and I was in the party, and we had about 18 or 20 men. Made the transfer through to the North Beach. Our objective was to cut off the 4th and 5th Division that already completed the assault through the two flanks, right and left side of the island. And the 3rd Division was pretty well through the center of the island, but the Japanese had runners going back and forth to keep communications going between the right flank and the left flank. We went in there to break up that runner, and they covered us up that night. We were dug in right on the cliffs on the northern beach, where we could look right down to the ocean, and the Japanese covered us up that night. That was the only night I knew I was going to make it home, but we held them off that night, and then the next morning, the Marines advanced up on the top of the ridge above us, and they could fire down in there, and the Japanese withdrew.
So if they hadn't done that, you were surrounded, and you really had no way out of that.
Yeah, we had no way out of it. That was the only night I really gave up hope of coming home.
What's it like in that moment? What's the internal dialogue?
Actually, I was at peace with it. I never had a fear of dying. I just had a fear of captured and painful dying. The lot of the fellows with me felt the same way.
Well, and we know close to 7,000 Americans were killed on that island. Were there some guys that you had gotten to know that you lost there?
I was real close with all the people in my squad. Mm-hmm. I visited with them a long time after the war. They'd come and visit me, and I'd go visit them. All of them died off, except for, I'm not sure whether Burke James is still alive in Missouri or not. Mm. And LaSalle, Francis LaSalle, I haven't heard anything about him in about 10 years. The last I knew, he was still alive in New Iberia, Louisiana.
What about the Marines who were killed there? Were any of your friends among
them? I had a lot of my platoons were killed. Binder and Sherman and Bohannon and a bunch of them, Christensen.
These are all guys you knew?
They were all killed on evil.
How did you process that as an 18-year-old? How did you work through that?
We got to where we accepted it right quick. We accepted death as being a part of life. I never have had a fear of dying.
Why not?
I was raised in this area here where we had a lot of old people passed away, and my mother had always taught me that dying is part of life. You're born, you live, and you die. And all of creation is circular. It goes in a circle. The stars form, they live, and they die, and something else comes up between them. So everything is cyclic, and I've never had I don't want to die, but I have no particular fear of it. I know it's inevitable, and I was raised that way.
So you mentioned the night where you're surrounded, and you said that's the first time you thought, I'm not going to make it out of here.
Yeah.
Were there some other close calls that you experienced before the day you were wounded?
Yeah, I was digging a foxhole on the north side of an observation hole. It was up on a high place. Our platooners dug into the lower part of the ridge, and they had a little point come up, and we were asked to go up and push up some rocks and dig us a foxhole on top of this little ridge, or we could see the Japanese coming in at night. They'd crawl in and get close to your foxhole, and sometimes they'd jump in with a live grenade and pop a grenade and jump the foxhole with you. Other times they'd get up close and just drop a couple of grenades in the foxhole with you. And they were really wizards at crawling in at night when the star shells were off. They would move ahead a ways, and then they'd cover up, and they were hard to see. And we dug a observation post with rocks and holes between the rocks so we could look out and not outline our helmets above the rocks. We were digging that foxhole. There was a great big flat sulfur rock in the bottom. I lifted it up and I raised it up, and I had to raise my head above the land over the side of the foxhole for reinforcement. And this Japanese machine gunner cut a layer of rock over, hit that rock, and blew gravel at my face. He'd have been a tenth of an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
A tenth of an inch?
Yeah.
That's pretty close. If that rock hadn't have been there,
rock hadn't have been there, I wouldn't have made it.
Yeah. Wow.
I had several close calls. I had lots of bullets pass within 6 inches of me. You could hear the crack of the bullet and feel the pressure, air pressure. Then I got out of the Marine Corps. I was still in the Marine Corps when my folks called me and told me this piece of property I'm living on now is for sale. So they went ahead and bought it, and then I paid for it after the GI loan after I got out of the service. And I've kept this for retirement property ever since. I got out of the Marine Corps, went back to work for the Navy Police Department, took some non-credit college courses, and finished my GED at high school, and went into game management. I worked for them for 32 years. Then after I left the Navy Police Department, we formed the first ambulance service. My wife was a nurse at the hospital down the road here. She was out there. She was working one day, and a guy had an accident of a canyon. She took my station wagon and went up there and got the girl out. She was really badly hurt. And they brought in the hospital and stabilized her, and then they hauled her by station wagon on to Albuquerque for more intensive care. A short time later, there was a guy showed up and wanted to see her ambulance. He wanted to thank us for what we did for the daughter. And they pointed the old station wagon out there, and he says, "I'm going to get you a new ambulance." So about a month later, a guy drove up with a new Dodge van, all equipped with gurneys and everything in it, and shelves for medication, for our equipment, and we formed the first ambulance north of Albuquerque.
Wow.
Before that, they'd send a hearse out and pick you up, and if you lived, they took you to the doctor. If you didn't live, they took you to the morgue. And so we had the first ambulance service. It was a busy service.
Wow. Well, there's so many directions we can go here.
Manned by volunteer EMTs.
Well, you talked about a couple close calls there on Iwo, but I've got to hear about the day you were wounded. Do you remember what day that was?
Yeah, that was March 15th, 1945.
If that day had unfolded a little bit differently, we would not be having this conversation with Carl Berghofer of Embuto, New Mexico. It's time for our final break, but we'll hear his Purple Heart story in vivid detail when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EEC. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit this week with Carl Berghofer of Embuto, New Mexico. He's still growing and selling fruit along the Rio Grande, right across State Road 68 from Embuto Valley Medical Center. Because Carl, of course, donated the land to build that medical center. On March 15, 1945, he was in need of some crucial medical care on the battlefield. Carl had already survived 23 days of combat on Iwo Jima and made it through some extremely close calls, but this would prove to be the closest call of all.
About 10 o'clock in the morning, we were making an advance. He was the last up toward Katano Point, was the last holdout of the Japanese troops. We were advancing. It was a beautiful morning. That morning we had brought us out the new sea rations. We enjoyed a good breakfast. Then they ordered us to move out, and we moved out to L Company and I Company combined, and we had about 20 men left of the two companies, and we made an advance across this. There was a series of ridges and flats and ridges and flats. We went from one ridge to the other. Finally, we came to a ridge, and we were blowing foxholes close as we went, dropping grenades at them. It wasn't a shot fired at us. We came up on this little ridge, and we raised up and looked over it, and I was one of the first to look over it. It looked like a mushroom field, Japanese helmets. Wow. And all of them had a rifle pointed at me. And I raised my legs up, and it took me 10 minutes to fall to the ground, and there was just a sheet of bullets came across the top of that ridge. The only way we could fire without getting hit was raise the rifles over his head and empty them in the general direction. And we threw all the grenades we had, and order finally came down for us to withdraw. And there was a flat area behind us and a big rock. So they started running one at a time, zigzagging and getting behind this rock. And I was about the fourth man through. The third man that went through, man, they really opened up on him, but he made it safely. And I made it about three jumps from that rock, and I got hit in the back of the head. I didn't know I got hit. Of course, I was knocked out. And I came to, I was laying on my face. My nose hurt. I thought I'd pull it and hit my nose on a rock. Then I felt the blood, and one of the guys behind the rock said, "Berghofer, you're still moving?" And I don't remember answering him, but he said, "If you can make about three jumps, I can grab you and pull you behind this rock." So I laid there a minute and got my equilibrium back, and I got to my feet, and he reached out and grabbed me.
Wow.
And I evacuated myself back to base hospital. When I got back to the base hospital, I was treated by Dr. Raymond, and he was a surgeon from Santa Fe.
How about that?
I met with him several times after the war.
So what was the extent of your injuries?
I got a bullet hit in the back of my head. It was a glancing blow, but it pulled out a little piece of bone. He treated it and put a plate in it. It was supposed to be silver, but I don't think it was. But it's since disappeared. It's been absorbed.
So you get hit. It knocks you unconscious.
Yeah.
You're lying on the ground.
Yeah.
They still have a line of sight on you, right?
I was still on the ground, so they quit shooting at me.
Right. Because you weren't moving, they stopped shooting.
Yeah.
If you had been moving, they probably would have shot you a few more times.
Yeah, they would have shot me again.
So it's a good thing you got knocked out.
Yeah.
Maybe saved your life.
Yeah.
And then you come to, and you don't know what happened.
I didn't know what had happened. I thought I'd fall and hit my head on a rock.
Because when you fell, I'm sure you did hit something.
Yeah,
huh?
I broke my nose, I know.
Broke your nose.
And I thought that was where the blood was coming from, but then I realized it was running down the side of my head. Head wounds bleed real bad.
And so it penetrated your helmet and the liner?
Yeah, it went through my helmet, in one side and out the other. Knocked a little 25 caliber hole going in. Some of my friends brought the helmet back to me on Guam. When they came back.
So when you're in the hospital recovering, they show up and give you the helmet?
I was in the hospital, and then I'd gone back to duty, and we were putting up the tents and everything for the Marines returning from Iwo. I was on duty already back on duty when they came back.
And so they gave you the helmet with two holes in it?
Yeah, I brought the helmet back, and I lost it somewhere in transit.
Oh, man. Well, again, I'm still just fascinated by this circumstance. You're 18 years old. You're shot in the head. You're unconscious. You come to. You're trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
And you know that the Japanese can still shoot you at any moment.
Yeah.
And your buddy's telling you, "Try to move over here and I'll grab you."
Yeah. He says, "Berghofer, can you hear me?" And I must answer him somehow. He says, "If you could make about two jumps," he says, "I could grab you." So I laid there and collected myself. I remember that. And then I got to my feet, and or I don't remember where I got clear to my feet or not. Anyway, I got up where I could jump and made about two or three jumps, and he grabbed me and pulled me higher than that rock. And the Japanese never did shoot at me.
But you knew you were going to be exposing yourself to that fire by jumping over there.
Yeah.
How far do you think you had to go?
About 6 or 8 feet.
So then you're able to walk and move fine. You just have blood
coming out of your head.
After
I got back there, they bandaged me up, and I evacuated myself.
You had to be in pain.
Now, those medical corpsmen I'm telling you, they were great people. They were great people. They were going in unarmed. A lot of them were Navy.
Right.
Medical corpsmen attached to the Marine unit. I remember when they get mass casualties, they'd borrow morphine. We carried a little pouch on our thing with it had a roller bandage and a pack of dressing and a tube of morphine and a sulfa.
Right.
In each one of your little packs we carried on our belt, on a cartridge belt. He'd go around and borrow morphine from different people in the sulfa because he didn't have enough in his pack to supply all the needs. And then we'd send back and he'd get replenishments.
So,
and one of the duties I dreaded on Iwo Jima was stretcher bearer duty. We'd pick up the wounded, sometimes the dead, and we'd carry them back to off the lines and back to a safe area, sometimes clear down to the beach to the hospital ships. And the hospital ships, and they set up a tent field hospital on Iwo. That's what I went to. But we'd carry, and we'd have two men to a stretcher. We'd put a man on a stretcher, and we'd run from one rock or foxhole to the next and dive in the hole. We were under fire at that time. And we'd get them back out of the firing area, and then we'd carry them down to the beach. And on the return trip, we'd pick up water and gasoline from frame throwers and extra ammunition and grenades and carry the loaded stretcher back to the lines. The stretcher duty was a hard duty. But I was on stretcher duty about 2 to 3 times a day.
And then, so when you get hit and you get yourself back to the field hospital.
Yeah.
And you told the surgeon from Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Put the plate in your head. Did you think you might get to go home?
I didn't think so at that time. But at that time, they didn't know about subdural hematomas.
Hmm.
You get a blow on one side of the head and the bruising is on the opposite side. And I suffered from severe headaches for months over my right temple. And actually, they were bad enough where I passed out a couple of times. And I was finally, after they dropped the atom bombs on Japan, I was immediately back to the States and given a medical discharge.
Well, I've got to ask you, too. I mean, the situation where you're digging that spot out and you set the rock up on the edge and you said you were a tenth of an inch away from being killed there.
Maybe an inch.
Maybe an inch.
If he'd been an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
How about when you got hit? What do you think the margin was there for you surviving versus getting killed?
Well, looking backwards now, in hindsight, I would say I had a 50-50 chance.
Because if he's a little lower, he could sever your spinal cord
without getting hit. And I had a good chance of being wounded.
I mean, I'm just thinking, if a bullet hits the back of your head, it's not very far from ending it for you right there.
Yeah, if he'd have let me just a speck more, he'd have caught me. He didn't realize how fast I was running.
I guess that's it.
Yeah.
How often have you thought about that over the years? Because now you've lived another...
I still have dreams about that. Every once in a while, I have dreams about that damn place.
I mean, and you've had 76 years since then.
Yeah.
And you're still farming. You're still active.
Yeah, I went back and went to work, and I concentrated on my job, and I take care of this place on weekends or days off or have a day or spell. I'd come in and work on the place. I built this house myself. It was built out of railroad ties, the old GNRGW railroad. They pulled it up at the beginning of World War II.
Uh-huh.
They pulled it up the railroad, and that really depressed the entire area. But they needed the iron for the rails for the war effort. They saved all the iron and all the spikes and everything and melted it out and put it into cannon and tank reinforcement.
So you salvaged the railroad ties and framed this house with it, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not trying to be dramatic or put thoughts in your head, but when you come that close to being killed at 18 years old, and now you look back you know, 76 years later, and you know the life you've had and the children and the grandchildren and all the impact you've had through your career and how many people you've fed through this farm. How do you account for all that? How do you size up what happened there and why?
Well, I'll tell you what it did. Teach me compassion. That's one thing I learned out of that Marine Corps experience was compassion from a fellow man.
I'm sure there's been a few times, you know, in all these years that you've seen that famous photo that Rosenthal took of those Marines raising that flag.
I've got pictures of it.
When you see that, what does it bring to mind for you?
Well, I remember all the people that were all in the service with me. Ira Hayes had helped raise the flag on Iwo Jima.
Right.
He was a Pima Indian, Apache Pima. I really admired him, and I looked up to him. He was brought against his will. He wanted to stay with his unit. He was brought against his will and went into war bond drive, and where they plied him with lots of whiskey and lots of food, and he wasn't used to that. I remember when he died, I felt real bad about it. He died in January in an irrigation ditch on the Pima Reservation, froze to death. I really felt bad about that.
Yeah, it was a tragic story.
He was a good man. It was all pores on him.
You mentioned that, you know, you had headaches for months after your injury. Have there been any other lasting effects of what happened to you?
No lasting effects. I went in and had a bone scan here about 10 years ago. I've lived a very active life. I've broken a lot of bones. And they said that head wound is completely cleaned up, healed up. And no sign of the plates that they were supposed to put in it. So I guess it was, they said they think it was probably absorbed it over the period of years.
It's been a long time.
But the headaches gradually went away after about, it was about a year.
I've heard a lot of Marines say, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Right today, I'm proud of the Corps. If I was to go in again, I would enlist the Marines. My younger son was in the Marines. He was in the 9th Regiment in Vietnam. He was wounded over there, and he died in a car wreck about 30 days after he came home.
Mm. Yeah, your family has quite a legacy of service, doesn't it?
Yeah, starting with my ancestral family, Jost Harbaugh came over from Kaiserslautern, Germany, settled in Pennsylvania, and his sons were involved in the French-Indian War. One of them was killed during Braddock's debacle. And he was in they fought on the Patriot side during the Revolutionary War. And my great-grandfather came from Hesse in Germany, and he was in the war with Mexico. He came in here with the Mormon battalion that came in. He wasn't a Mormon, but he was with the Missouri Mounted Cavalry, and they went on to California. And then my grandfather was in the Spanish-American War with Cuba. My father was in World War I, and I was in World War II. My brother was in the Korean War, and I had two sons in the Vietnam War, and then I've had grandkids that served in the Gulf War.
Hasn't missed any generations, has it?
Yeah, we've had generations of people that volunteer for the service.
Well, when you think about that, especially with your generation, you know, I think about what you told me, that you had 240 men in your company going into Iwo Jima. And by the end of that campaign, there were only 11 who hadn't been cooled.
11 of the original people. We had been replaced three or four times.
Because those are all casualties.
The casualties were replaced with raw recruits. And we'd been replaced three or four times. So actually, our company probably suffered 120% casualties.
Which seems impossible, but it's not. Well, and I don't mean to make light of that, because this is life or death. These are high stakes. And just those statistics you cite tell us that the odds were not in your favor, right? You had to beat some significant odds to survive.
Well, I probably had an 80% chance of being wounded and about a 20% chance of being killed on Iwo.
Have you ever tried to answer the question why? Or how? Why or how you survived?
I was attributed to luck. I was just lucky. And I was well trained to keep undercover and use the terrain as much as I could for protection. And I had been raised in the outdoors and hunting and trapping and farming. And my time in the Game and Fish Department, so I was pretty well, I was in good physical shape. The practice that animals practice with people. Learned how to hide and conceal and when to run and when not to. And
mm-hmm. I'm sure when you were on Iwo, you saw some of the crosses there.
Yeah, I went down to visit the cemetery before I left Evil. Before I got wounded, in fact, I'd see just lines and lines of crosses.
Well, how should those guys be remembered?
They should be remembered as guys that didn't want to go, but went because they were asked to, and it was their duty to go. They sacrificed themselves for a good cause. If the Army and the Navy and the Marine Corps hadn't won World War II, we'd be a Japanese and German-speaking nation right today. People never know how close we come to losing World War II. That's my own opinion. Hitler made a few mistakes, serious mistakes, that cost him the war. One thing, he made a mistake of not taking Iceland and following the invasion into England, because England had very little in the way of defense. If he'd have followed his attack after Dunkirk and gone on into England, they couldn't have repelled him. And if he'd have taken England and Iceland, we wouldn't have had any way of defeating him from American shores.
Well, there's a few other questions that I have for you. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story.
Don't think of thanking me, because it was just part of my duty, your young life.
Well, most people haven't gone through what you went through, and you're telling us that story helps us understand that price that's been paid for the freedom we enjoy. I'm wondering for you, as you look back over 95 years, is there something you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Well, I'm thankful for my life, with my family and my wife and my kids. I've had a good life, actually. I've lived a good life. I've been active all my life, and I can't complain.
And is there anything that you're still looking forward to that you haven't done yet?
Oh, I'd like to do a lot of things, but my eyesight and my hearing, and I just can't see to do them. I'd like to do some more help for my neighbors and my friends that I'm just not able to do anymore. I went into volunteer work with ambulance service and fire service, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed helping others.
As someone who has farmed this land for as long as you have,
yeah,
is there some advice you would have for other people who pursue that? Or is there something maybe you think that people misunderstand about that?
Well, farming is a dedicated work. It's not a five-day-a-week, it's a seven-day-a-week job. The fruit grows and the weeds grow and everything on Saturdays and Sundays, just without an exception. But it's a good life, and I would recommend it to most everybody. I think everybody nowadays ought to turn their lawns and the town into gardens, produce something good. They can raise fruit and vegetables on half the water the lawn takes.
And what keeps you going with that? Why do you still do it? What motivates you?
Well, I just like it. I just enjoy it. There's a divine plan for things. I believe there's a God. I believe God watches over us. But I think he also makes you help yourself. He might help you to help yourself. I'm sure that God is with us. It has an influence on our lives. I'm positive of that. But I also believe that he helps you to help yourself more than protect you.
One more question about your farming operation here. Is there a particular fruit, tree, or crop that you're most proud of that's your pride and joy?
Cherries and apricots. I like to eat them, I like to raise them, and they're a good seller of produce.
What variety of apricots do you grow?
I got several different varieties. I raise from seeds myself. My cherries, I have Bings, Royal Ads, and Yellow Transparents, or Golden Cherries.
I guess one more question I have to ask. It may sound a little trite or cliche, but I think it's relevant because people can hear how energetic you are. Not everybody your age is still as active as you are, doesn't have a memory as sharp as yours. So I've got to ask you, what's your secret?
Well, just everything in moderation. Eat plenty of good food, a little meat, a little grain, a little potatoes, lots of fruit, and stay active. That's the thing, just stay active.
There is no question he stays active. And the next time you pass through Embuto, New Mexico on State Road 68, or the River Road to Taos, as it's often called, you may be able to literally taste the fruit of his labor. Carl Berghofer, celebrating birthday number 95 this week. Big thanks to Maria Baca for letting us know about her friend Carl. For photos and a short video from Carl's orchard along the Rio Grande, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I hope you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.